Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studios on the seventh floor of Trib Tower. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews coming up just now. And we are going to talk about comedic actors when they take on serious roles. And talk about some of those, some of the best dramatic performances by what, you know, most actors and actresses are known for comedy. We'll talk about that a little bit later on as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk or text. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, bunch of new movies to talk about. We got the box office coming up. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning for the Monday morning movie reviews. And then Eric sticks around and we talk box office as well. Let's welcome Eric to the show. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome, Colin.
Hello there.
All right, guys. Let's get into it. Let's see. There are a couple of movies that you guys didn't see that I did. That would be... Traffic. You guys didn't see Traffic, right?
No.
And Ghost Stories, which just debuted on VOD. So I'll get to those in a couple of minutes. But why don't we start with one that I did not see, which is The Endless. So, Eric, why don't you tell us about The Endless?
Okay. Well, this is a new film from Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, whose last film was the really terrific sort of horror romance called Spring. They're actually the stars of this movie as well. They play two brothers who several years ago were part of this very strange cult that they managed to get to escape from. But then they receive kind of a cryptic videotape that kind of gives them some further information about some things that might have gone on or might be going on at the cult. And one of the brothers has still kind of got kind of a pull to sort of go back there. There's sort of kind of something missing in his life that he just can't quite escape from, and he kind of wants to go back there and get closure, much to the reluctance of his other brother. But the two of them end up going back there and are welcome back with open arms. But there are some strange things, obviously, as one might expect from a cult, although this one maybe even a little bit stranger. It seems that the people there don't seem to have aged very much, and other things abound that you really don't want to get into when describing the film, because one of the really great things about this movie is the absolute sense of discovery and mystery that's going on, that continues to go on throughout this movie. It's constantly evolving into new territory and creepy territory that you know, seems very, very original. It's a movie that I haven't quite seen done before. And there's just a lot of it's a really hard movie to describe, other than talking about just that these two guys, Benson and Moorhead, are so incredibly original and talented, and crafted something here that is constantly keeping you on your toes, is full of really rich ideas, and also there's a real emotional undercurrent going on that, we really feel for these characters. It's not taking you down paths that you really can see coming. And, again, it's the sort of the less you know about going into this movie, the better. But you're going to be very rewarded coming out the other end of it. It's certainly one of the more interesting horror sci-fi films that I've seen as of late. And definitely one of the more interesting films that has been released this year so far.
Okay. By the way, it's playing at the Music Box for everybody who's interested. Colin, what'd you think?
This was a really amazing movie that I've been thinking about quite a bit since I saw it earlier this week. And one of the interesting things it does, I'm a bit of a sucker for movies about cults and things like this. And you know, one of the interesting things this movie does is it knows that the audience is on the side of the brother who's suspicious and, you know, reluctant to embrace all this. And so, you know, we go, you know, because we're kind of conditioned to think that way when we see movies like this. And the movie kind of dismantles that, and you know, we're looking for the clues for, you know, what is wrong with this place, and yet we can kind of understand the other brother's appeal, or you know, why it appeals to him. You know, these things offer you know, a place to live, and it's a very agreeable, and it's not, you know, you know, you eat three meals a day, and the peace and quiet away from the hustle and bustle and of the real world. And but yet we're constantly having the rug pulled out from under us, because, you know, there are things about this place that are unusual. And and I agree with Eric. I mean, I'm also trying to be vague and everything, but there's a sense of dread, and also at the same time, the sense of a weird sense of kind of a wonder about it all, because it's just such a very these guys have created a really interesting world here, and it's not like your typical cult where you have one cult leader who is very charismatic and controlling and everything. It's way more abstract than that, which is also a nice twist on this kind of material. So yeah, without saying too much, I mean, this is definitely, if you're looking for more thought provoking sci-fi and horror, and, you know, like stuff like Annihilation appeals to you. Not that this is in that same vein, but, you know, but we are living in a time when we're being presented with really interesting, challenging science fiction and horror, and this is definitely in the same category as movies like, you know, Midnight Special, where you're constantly guessing and constantly being challenged, and the whole result is very rewarding. So this is definitely, I think, one of the best films of the year. People should definitely check it out.
Okay, that's The Endless, and it's playing at the Music Box. All right, cool. All right, I'll tell you guys about Ghost Stories. Ghost Stories is a British movie directed by Jeremy Dyson and Andy Nyman, who also appears in the film. And it is a, it's on video on demand. That's how I saw it. Just became available on Friday. And it's British anthology horror movie. It's a throwback to the films of the 60s and 70s that Hammer and mostly Amicus Studios put out. Movies like Vault of Horror, Tales from the Crypt, House That Dripped Blood, Asylum. These are all classic anthology movies, and of course everybody remembers, you know, Creepshow from the 80s and Creepshow 2 and some of the other anthology horror movies. But this is really in the tradition of the British Amicus films. The connecting element of the movie is there's this this guy who's on a professor who's on a television star who debunks supernatural stuff and does it on a TV show very spectacularly and very arrogantly, and is a skeptic and doesn't believe in this, and his entire job as a TV star is to debunk all these supernatural or ghost stories that he comes across. Very popular man. His mentor is an older gentleman who did the same thing years earlier, and he's a much older man now, and he calls his character to see him and says that he's had a change of heart, that he now believes, that he's not a skeptic anymore, and he feels bad about, you know, what he did all those years ago, debunking and, you know, mocking and not believing. But he has definitely had a change of heart, and it's because of these three stories that he knows now. So he suggests to the professor, this TV star, to check out these three stories, these three people who have these separate stories, and see if it changes his mind about whether or not he's going to believe anymore. So that's the setup, and then it's three separate scary ghost stories. And all three of them are very, very good. They're good in different ways. It's subtle. The final one stars Martin Freeman, and that's the scariest one of all of them. They all involve ghosts. They all involve it, but it's a very. This is not kind of like the bad Blumhouse, like with the stuff that we were talking about, the Truth or Dare stuff, where it's like jump scares every 5 seconds. They really set up the mood in this movie. It's an old-fashioned horror movie, and it really does echo back to those anthology movies that I grew up watching, you know, with the ones with Peter Cushing and all those other ones, the British actors. And it really has that feel to it, and it's subtle, and it's scary. There's a lot of creaking doors, and I mean, you know, we talked about A Quiet Place for the past couple of weeks about the use of subtlety and sound in that. Same thing here is that it's you know, it's a movie that really builds up the mood, and the scares are all earned, and the connecting element is really interesting. There's a nice through line with the main character who is part of each of the stories or hears each of the stories, and there's a great little twist at the end. It's really well cast, it's really beautifully made, and it's scary. And it is a creepy, scary movie, and it earns all of the suspense and all of the scares it gets. It's not gross. This is a triumph of mood and style over, say, you know, jump scares and gore. This is like, it really did remind me of my childhood and those British anthology horror movies that I grew up loving. And it really brought me back to that time in a very wonderful way. So it's a wonderful tribute to those Amicus stories, and in its own right, very scary and really, really well cast. And Martin Freeman, by the way, really good in it. All the cast is very good in it too, but this is quality stuff. It's a very, very creepy, good, solid horror movie called Ghost Stories. You guys should check it out because it's really good.
So, great, good.
All right, so that's Ghost Stories. We're going to take a break. Guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric is going to hang on, so is Colin, and we're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, we got more movies to talk about, plus box office as well, right here on 720 WGN on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're back, and before the news, we were reviewing the movies. We're going to continue to do that. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey joke time. And we're going to talk about when comedic actors take on dramatic roles, or, you know, comedic actors and actresses who are mostly known for comedy, and then when they do some dramatic stuff, and we'll see how that works out. So that's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can email us and text us, and you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and at Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. We're reviewing the new movies. Let's welcome everybody back. Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, I'll tell you guys about Traffic. This is with a K, not C, not to be confused with the Steven Soderbergh film from like 17 years ago. So here's the setup for this movie. Paula Patton, who I really enjoy looking at, stars in this movie as a journalist in Northern California who is just about fired from her job. William Fichter is her editor. She feels that she got ripped off. Somebody scooped a story that she was working on. She's not being respected as the journalist that she is and the writer that she is. And having a really bad time at work, her boyfriend decides that, you know, to take her mind off of this, she's having so many troubles at work, she may not even have a job. To take her mind off of this, on her birthday, he will take her up to this incredible, unbelievably beautiful, cool house that's up in the mountains in Northern California that has an incredible view. It's like a mansion. It's amazing. It's got an insane swimming pool outside on the edge of this mountain. And they're just going to go up there, and they're going to have a romantic weekend. And what she doesn't know is that he is planning on proposing to her, even though she's like a commitment phobe and she doesn't really want to do this. Meanwhile, their two friends, they show up unexpectedly and surprise them in the house, and they're going to spend the weekend there with them as well. Now, on the way up to the cabin or to the big house, They stop for gas at a gas station, and they notice that there are some what look like motorcycle gang members there, bearded, tattooed guys, weird hair, the whole nine. And there is a confrontation between one of the tatted up bikers and her boyfriend. There's a fight, and they almost have a fight. And then, meanwhile, Paula Patton's character goes inside the store at the gas station to get a Slurpee and some other supplies and stuff. Goes in, uses the bathroom, and has an encounter with a very strange looking woman who appears to have been battered and doesn't look well and looks like she needs help and is kind of hinting at Paula Patton's character that she needs some help. What Paula Patton doesn't know is that the girl that she encounters drops a phone into her purse, and doesn't know this. They get up to the cabin, they have a nice romantic time, the other friends show up, and then suddenly the phone starts making noise, and she's like, this isn't my phone. They open up the phone and they look at it, they unlock the phone, and they notice that there are a bunch of pictures of women in various states of dress and also in looking like they're beaten up and chained. And then you find out that this biker gang is not just a biker gang, but they're part of a human sex trafficking system that's happening. And so the biker gang shows up. They want the phone back, and it becomes kind of a home invasion. They're out there, you're inside, kind of a thing. Then, you know, they're getting hunted down into the woods by these characters, and then it shifts into this human sex trafficking subplot, with all these women tied up in a semi truck, and just being trafficked by these guys. And it's a big operation. And then all, you know, Missy Pyle plays a sheriff in the small town, and she's aware of what's happening, and so that's the whole setup. And it's up to whether or not that they're going to survive, and how many people are going to get killed, and you know, will these bikers stop, and you know, is there anything that they can do about this human trafficking thing? So that's the basic setup of the movie, and that's pretty much what happens. It's pretty standard. Paula Patton's very good in it, though, and I've always been a fan of hers, and I think she's very good in this. I just don't think the material is quite up to par. It's a very sort of schizophrenic movie because it doesn't know exactly what it wants to be. Is it? I mean, because there's a lot of romantic stuff in the movie that doesn't really work, and is this relationship going to work? And she's a commitment phobe, and should this guy propose? There's a lot of time spent on their relationship, which doesn't really have a big emotional payoff. The other two characters, the friends that show up, the main guy who's like the best friend is a jerk, and like I wouldn't spend 2 minutes with this guy, and they're like incredibly annoying. And then you know, like there is a little bit degree of satisfaction because this guy is one of the first, you know, to have to deal with these motorcycle guys and these human trafficking guys. And then it becomes like your standard. Are they going to make it? They're in the, you know, they're in the woods. They're going to be tracked down. What's going on? Can this sheriff played by Missy Pyle help them out? What are they going to do? Of course, they're in the middle of the woods. They don't have a phone. They can't do that. They, you know, so it's that standard kind of stuff. And then the final like third of the movie is, you know, in-depth human trafficking, like human sex trafficking with these women who are being beat up, and it's very unpleasant. The last like 20 minutes of this movie is just really unpleasant to watch. It's a lot of women getting smacked around and drugged up and chained up, you know, and then, you know, it leads up to this big climax, and at the end of the movie, at the very end of the movie, they show these really depressing numbers and facts about human sex trafficking that's happening right now. So there's all these facts that they show at the end of the movie, and it's shocking, and then, you know, the movie ends. But here's the problem. It doesn't earn that. You know, like at the end of the movie when they show all those facts, suddenly it's like, oh, wait a minute. We were supposed to be taking this movie seriously? Like, this is like a serious film about – this is what they really wanted to make, a serious film about sex trafficking, and what they ended up making was a B-movie – with, you know, like three different subplots that we've seen 8 million times before, and a screenplay that does not earn those facts at the end. You know what I mean? Like, it's like a subpar thriller that suddenly, oh, wait a minute, we're supposed to take this seriously? So as a result, they've really mishandled the whole trafficking element of it, which at its core is what it wants to be about. It's not a terrible movie. You know, I think some of the cast members are really good. Like I mentioned, Paula Patton is good. There's, you know, Missy Pyle's having a really good time in this movie. I don't want to, for people who are going to see it, I don't want to ruin it, but there's a twist involving her character. And then she really gets to have a fun time in the film for like the final hour. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's a standard, it's sort of a standard B-movie thriller that combines elements we've seen a million times before, but then suddenly it wants to be taken very seriously as some sort of humanistic and political statement about human trafficking, and it just doesn't earn it. So anyway, that's Traffic. I'm not recommending it. It's not a terrible movie. I'm just not recommending it, and it certainly takes a very serious subject. I'd rather see like an investigative documentary about this situation than watch sort of a substandard B thriller about it. So anyway, I am not recommending Traffic. So don't rush off, guys. To see it. Yeah. All right. I did not see I Feel Pretty. So, Colin, why don't you tell us about I Feel Pretty?
All right. Well, this stars Amy Schumer as a woman who works for a high-end cosmetics company. But she works on the website in the basement with another guy, and she doesn't feel too good these days about her prospects of slimming down and finding a man who will accept her in the, you know, brutal dating climate. And, you know, she doesn't feel good about getting a promotion at her job. She wants to be the receptionist for this company. You know, the first face a client sees when they walk into the place, because, you know, she's not the ideal face that is typical of the fashionistas and models who work there and represent the type of women who buy these products. She's more of a Target shopper than a high-end shopper. And one night she, while watching the movie Big, she gets the idea and makes a wish in a fountain on a rainy night to be beautiful. And next day when she wakes up after she has an accident at a health club, she sees herself in the mirror as tall, thin, beautiful model type. But no one else sees this. In fact, we, the audience, don't see it either. Only Schumer's character sees it. And suddenly she's imbued with this sense of self-confidence that she never had before. And her behavior changes. And this leads to a new boyfriend, played by Rory Scovel, and a promotion at her job, which is run by the cosmetics company she's worked for is run by Michelle Williams, as a woman who with a high-pitched voice who feels she has a kinship with Schumer's character. She's pretty insecure too, even though she's, you know, the face of this company. But Schumer's character thinks everyone sees her as confident and thin now. So this is one of those.
Okay, hang on. Hang on.
Okay,
hold on a second. We got the plot. Everybody hang on. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll find out what Colin and Eric thought of I Feel Pretty, which is Amy Schumer's new movie. And we'll get all the details on that right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we're going to talk about when comedic actors and actresses take on dramatic roles. That's all coming up right here on the show. We are in the middle of the movie reviews for Monday morning movie reviews here. Colin Suter, Eric Childress join me every week to review the new movies. We're in the middle of doing that, and then Eric will stick around, and we'll talk about the box office for the weekend. Before we took a break, Colin told us about I Feel Pretty, which is Amy Schumer's new comedy. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Colin, continue. I Feel Pretty.
Yeah, so this is a movie that, you know, is very much in the same, at least plot-wise, very much in the same vein as Big and Liar Liar and movies like that. Movies that are just kind of, you know, make a wish, okay, then it happens, and we don't have to explain it or anything like that, or realize, you know, how did this thing happen? So, and I think it's an interesting premise in that we never see the person that Amy Schumer sees in the mirror. you know, we're kind of every other character in the film. And I think that's a pretty interesting twist on this. And I was kind of going along with this movie for about 45 minutes or so because of that twist. And because Schumer seemed to be trying to play a real character here and not or a real person here and not just somebody who gets all the funny lines and everybody reacts to everything around her. You know, there are bits of pratfalls and slapsticks and stuff like that. But, you know, it seemed, you know, that this was going to be a sort of toned down kind of romantic comedy or, you know, fantastical comedy than we've seen lately. And then it kind of settles into the routine of being that movie where, you know, she the more successful she gets, the more she alienates herself from her friends and her boyfriend. And, you know, once the gift or curse, whatever you want to call it, that she gets, you know, starts to just get dismantled a little bit, then she's, you know, then you can kind of telegraph this A to B to C to D and everything, and you'd be exactly right on. And, you know, I think the movie only just kind of scratches the surface about, you know, the importance of appearance in our culture and how our appearance sort of dictates our self-esteem. The movie seems to be well on its way to making interesting statements about that, like I said, in the first 45 minutes or so, but it never quite follows through. This was written and directed by Abby Cohn and Mark Silverstein, who are, you know, have delved in this genre pretty much throughout their whole careers with movies like Never Been Kissed and The Vow and He's Just Not That Into You. So, you know, and they kind of seem more interested in just creating your average romantic comedy with this fantastical element in it than really saying something interesting about appearance in our culture. And that's unfortunate because I think there's a lot of promising there's promising things in here. There's good stuff in here to work with. And the best thing to work with in here is actually Michelle Williams as the head of this cosmetics company. She steals every scene she's in. She is hilarious.
That's a real shocker to me that the best thing in the movie is Michelle Williams.
Right, yeah. I'm not as down on Amy Sherman as you are. I actually think she's very funny much of the time. So I didn't have high hopes going into this, but I thought, well, maybe this will be okay. And it is just that. For me, it's okay. I'm not recommending it or anything. I've seen worse this year, you know, but it's a lot of missed opportunities, unfortunately.
Okay. All right. Eric, what'd you think?
I think that this is one of the most confused movies I've seen in some time, with the exception of the one real positive element Colin mentioned there that I'll get to back to in a second. This is a film that not only seems to have no idea of what it wants to really be and what it really wants to say about, you know, these sort of very real issues that could be explored for both, you know, serious confidence in society as well as satire. It doesn't quite have the kind of the light charm that, you know, say like a movie like The Truth About Cats and Dogs had several years ago, or the kind of the dark angle that Neil LaBute had with The Shape of Things. It's not even a film that falls somewhere squarely in the middle of those movies. I mean, those are on their own timeline, and this movie is kind of, you know, sort of breezing by, kind of tiptoeing past everything that made those films work in different ways. And I mean, the premise of the movie, I mean, you know, again, say what you will about Amy Schumer, but this is the kind of premise that it seemed like, you know, would probably have killed in like a 6-minute sketch segment on her Inside Amy Schumer show, particularly the moment where she first, you know, believes that she has transformed herself into this beautiful character. You know, this movie never, I mean, because it's a delicate balance when you're dealing with subject matter like this as to what defines beauty, beauty, whether it's in the eye of a beholder, yourself, the confidence that it lends you, the doors that it opens because of it. It never really has anything interesting to say about that and doesn't seem interested in even exploring it, frankly. The character, the Amy Schumer character, at times is incredibly inconsistent with the newfound power that she has. Sometimes she's, you know, completely, you know, acting like she's, you know, this, you know, character that really, you know, can get away with, you know, being a certain way in public. And there are other times where there's still this awkwardness that she maintains from her old self. And again, that's something that's very interesting to explore, except the movie its screenplay doesn't really have a measure of how to define that. And these scenes where, you know, she should be acting a lot more confident with, you know, the best looking guy in the movie, and she doesn't have that. I like the kind of like the relationship she has with the new guy in her life, and not enough can be said about Michelle Williams in this movie. And you know, there are people that are like going, where did this performance come from? When all of a sudden, how great is this comedic genius? Like, well, you could go back and watch Dick.
Yeah.
For one, she doesn't have this in her. Go watch My Week with Marilyn. She's, you know, there's moments in that movie where she's very funny.
Or Manchester by the Sea was hilarious.
Oh. Yes, that one scene was just a laugh riot.
Oh, man.
Fantastic.
I laughed until I cried during that scene.
but in this movie, like, and there's not enough of her for one thing. And but every time she, the movie has this kind of this parallel view of her character with the Schumer character. You keep wishing that it would just shift to her character and be all about her. I would much rather have seen Michelle Williams' character be the focal center of this movie with her confidence issues. And again, the movie never really quite explores that. It just has the benefit of Michelle Williams doing some really beautiful, subtle physical comedy in this movie. So good. Like, I think it's actually one of the best performances of the year in the few scenes that she's in. But other than that, I can't recommend this movie at all. There are a few laughs scattered, mostly by Michelle Williams. But other than that, I mean, these are bad screenwriters who ruined a perfectly good premise.
Mm, okay. All right, that's I Feel Pretty and Amy Schumer's new movie, and Eric and Colin are not recommending it. All right, hang on, guys. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we got a couple more movies to review, and then Eric will stick around and we'll talk box office. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, we're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 o'clock, and it's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. And we're going to talk about actors and actresses who are known for comedy and then did some drama and how that worked out for them. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Eric Childress, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin Suter, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Now, the reason why I'm going to talk about that topic about mostly known as comedic actors doing dramatic roles is essentially because of the movie we're about to talk about, Eric. So, but tell everybody about Kodachrome.
Okay. This is a film that premiered at the Toronto Film Festival last year, which is where I saw it. I think I talked about it on the show back then. But it stars Jason Sudeikis as a music executive who is kind of not having the best time of it. He's not the new bands are not really there for him to sign anymore, at least the bands that he wants to sign for his record label. They're more interested in, you know, sort of newer music and stuff like that. So he kind of feels like he might be on his way out. Then he gets a message from his sort of estranged father's assistant, played by Elizabeth Olsen, assistant and nurse, actually, that his father, played by Ed Harris, is dying of cancer, and only he has probably a few months to live. And he has discovered few rolls of film, of Kodachrome film, that he wants to get developed. The thing is that there's actually only one location in the United States, in Kansas, that is still developing this type of film, and they're actually closing in a few days. So he wants his son to drive him to this location and to get this film developed. So road trip. So you have these three characters essentially hitting the road. Father and son have not had a good relationship over the years. His father is a world famous photographer, and part of the reason he wants to get this film developed, it gives him sort of one last spot on his legacy to get this maybe one last exhibit up. So you have great success on one hand, the sort of menial success happening right now for the son, and there's friction there. And then you have Elizabeth Olsen character kind of in the middle that in most movies would kind of seem kind of a prop, kind of just kind of a female love interest potential in there, but there's a little, the character is written a little bit better than I think some of those a lot of those standard type of roles usually are, although it does fulfill the cliches that you are expecting throughout the movie. And this is a movie that could very easily be sort of labeled as cliched and familiar. Anytime you have a road trip movie with two characters that need to sort out their differences, God knows how many times we've seen that. But the big difference here is in the performances. Sudeikis and Harris. Ed Harris is one of my all time favorite actors, and Sudeikis has increasingly shown what a real capable, powerful presence he can have on screen. Obviously, Colossal was on all of our top 10 lists last year, and I think we'd all admit that he was an absolute, kind of a revelation in that movie, a real standout. And he has been in other movies as well. Sleeping with Other People, another film from a few years ago, showed that he had a real capability as a romantic lead as well. And I think, the scenes between him and Harris, particularly in the back half of the movie, are really good. It's a movie that it's not breaking a lot of new ground. It is very familiar, and it's the kind of movie that I think is described. I think I've described it a couple times before as kind of a perfect Netflix movie, which is exactly where you can see it. There's actually kind of a rich irony here that this movie is all about the sort of the analog and the digital world.
Yeah.
And here you have, a movie that bought by a studio that is famous for bypassing theaters altogether.
Oh yeah, well, it is playing at the Century. It is playing at the Landmark Century. Yeah. Yeah. I saw it on Netflix. So.
Right. And that is a rare thing. There's not a lot of Netflix movies that actually make it in the theaters, let alone in the Chicagoland area. This one happens to. But this is the kind of movie that is kind of, a perfect weekend viewing if you don't want to leave the house. It's satisfying, particularly because of the performances. Again, it's not breaking any new ground, little lesser performances, I probably wouldn't be recommending it at all, but I can with this one.
Okay, I think I may have liked it more than you did, because I think it's really good. And you mentioned that the irony at the end of this movie, one of the credits very proudly says that it was shot on 35mm Kodak film. I watched it on a tablet. So, that final credit, I was like, oh, are you kidding me, man? It was shot, and they proudly, because the whole movie is, like you said, the whole movie is about, the tangible, the old stuff, the analog stuff. So many shots of Ed Harris loading a camera, an old school camera, with actual film, Sudeikis not knowing how to do that, and all that stuff. And then it's on Netflix. It's on Netflix, which I just found the irony to be massive. While I was like, I just watched this movie on my tablet, and so, this stuff has been done a million times before. Bastard father who abandoned the kid, cheated on the wife. That character has existed. I think every week there's a movie with that character in it. They've been estranged for over a decade. That stuff has happened, and Sudeikis doesn't want to go on this trip. And, they've got these massive differences, and Ed Harris can be a real jerk in this movie. There's a scene where they go and visit his younger brother, played by Bruce Greenwood. And his wife, played by Rendy Crewson, and what he does, this nightmare dinner table scene that Ed Harris pulls out, and just like, are they going to, you know, become friends, or are they going to learn to love each other before this guy dies? And again, it's the dying, you know, the dying person and being taken care of by Elizabeth Olsen, who plays the nurse assistant, all that stuff. And so it's not like we've never seen this before, but I think this movie really earns the emotion that it really kicks up in the final scene of the movie. I think the final scene in the movie is really beautiful. And Sudeikis is terrific in this movie. And so, I mean, Ed Harris, again, it goes without saying, Ed Harris is great. He's got a scene late in the film where they finally kind of break through, and he's got this monologue about a memory that he has involving Jason Sudeikis that's just beautiful.
Yeah, and terrific scene.
Beautifully delivered. And the reaction shots in Sudeikis' case is just great. Elizabeth Olsen is terrific in this movie. She's charming and she's funny. And you like her and you root for her. And she's like this great go-between between these two guys. And again, the Bruce Greenwood shows up for just a couple of quick scenes. And he's great in it. And Wendy Crewson's great in it as well. So, yeah, I mean, this is standard stuff. It's been done before. Road trip movie, father-son relationship, dying father. All of that stuff has been done, but I really, really like this movie because of the chemistry between the cast and how good everybody is in it. And I think it's a well-written movie that earns its emotion. And there's also like a fantastic shout out to the 90s band Live.
Yes, there is
in the movie,
which
I enjoyed quite a bunch. And there's also, you know, like a lot of really great moments where the characters are slowly sort of changing. There's a scene in the movie where Sudeikis, in a last ditch effort to keep his job, goes to Chicago and sees this hot band and then tries to close them.
Mm-hmm.
And something happens during the meeting. They're all kind of like backstage after the concert. Sudeikis is trying to close these guys to get them to sign to his smaller label as opposed to the big corporate label that they're working on now. He takes the advice of Ed Harris, which is good, of Ed Harris on trying to sell these guys. And then something happens involving Ed Harris. And Sudeikis' reaction to it is beautifully acted. Like, really, really beautiful.
It's a great scene.
It's a terrific scene. And a movie that's filled with really good scenes. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, road trip, dying father, let's settle our differences, romantic interest. Okay, it's been done. It's been done a lot, but it's done really well here. So I liked it. I just, you know, I thought that credit was ridiculous. I'm holding my tablet in my hand, reading about how they were proudly filming this movie in 35 millimeter Kodak. And I'm like, oh,
yeah. Netflix didn't have, I saw it in Toronto in a theater.
Yeah.
And Netflix obviously hadn't bought it yet.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, if you get a chance to see it, I mean, it would be nice to see, you know, because it was shot in 35. Go see it at the lake at the Landmark Century.
There's a whole section of the movie that's actually in Chicago.
Yeah, there's a huge section of the movie that's in Chicago as well. So, anyway, good movie. I liked it very much. If you choose to watch it on Netflix, that's cool. If you can get out to the theater to see it, that's cool. But I think it's really good, and I enjoyed Kodachrome very much. Yeah. Okay, guys, hang on. Okay.
Okay.
All right. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got Super Troopers 2 to talk about and box office. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, we're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in a little while. And we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews, and we'll talk box office as well. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, join me every Monday morning for the reviews. And let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Colin, tell us all about Super Troopers 2.
All right. Well, this is the latest from the Broken Lizard comedy team, and it's a sequel to their first big film from 2001. And it's 17 years later, and the troopers are now they're now a traveling rock band, but are brought back to their profession once a little land dispute between Vermont and Canada arises. That sends these idiots to the border as part of a transition between this little plot of land that now belongs to America. And so it's up to the super troopers to do the highway patrolling while also, in their eyes, trying to make sure the Canadians start acting like Americans now.
And, you know, there are three Mounties that are the Canadian equivalent to the American Super Troopers and their idiotic behavior. And so there's a rivalry there. But why is this land dispute happening? Well, there's an ulterior motive behind it, and I guess I'll leave that out. But suffice to say, there are a lot of jokes here at the expense of both Americans and Canadians, with Rob Lowe playing the man in charge of this transition, and he has a very exaggerated Canadian accent. It's one of the funnier things in the movie. So you might be thinking with this storyline that maybe Broken Lizard is feeling up to the task of taking on the sort of border politics that we read about every day and, you know, bringing the super troopers in to make some kind of weird statement about that. If that is the case, it kind of falls flat in that regard. This is basically just more, really, this is more of an excuse to do more super troopers hijinks from the first film and to make a few callbacks and echoes from that. I've seen, I just went back on IMDb and looked at, you know, what, how many movies Broken Lizard has made, and they've made more than what I've seen. I've seen four of them, and the two that I like the most are not the Super Troopers movies, but actually Beer Fest and Club Dread. And I wouldn't call those movies comedic masterpieces. I think they're mostly hit or miss movies, but they're like 60-65% hit, so, you know, just funny enough to be, you know, to recommend. And Super Troopers, yeah, that was just okay. Not as good as those two. And this one is actually not as good as Super Troopers 1. Just on the laugh meter alone, this movie is kind of, it feels like it's from, you know, an era when it might have been funnier, you know, like, say, 17 years ago when the first one came out. But I'm, you know, just kind of seeing a lot of obvious and repeated humor here. You know, and I just, like I said, on the laugh meter alone, I think I laughed maybe three or four times, and not huge laughs, but, you know, just chuckles, I guess. Funniest stretch of the movie is when the super troopers wear the Mountie outfits and do all this ridiculous behavior to try to make Canadian Mounties look bad. That's where most of the laughs came from for me. But, you know, just, this is, I was kind of looking forward to this because I think, you know, just, I was looking forward to a surprisingly hilarious dumb comedy. And, you know, Broken Lizard is really good at making dumb comedies. Well, often they're good. Well, I couldn't believe the last one, that Beer Fest was 2006.
I know, man.
Yeah. That's how long it's been?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so this is a disappointing movie for me.
Okay. Everybody hang on. Okay. Eric, hang on. Mm-hmm. And Colin, mm-hmm. hang on. And we'll take a break and we'll come back. We'll find out. After the news, we'll find out what Eric thought of Super Troopers 2, and I'll tell you what I thought of Super Troopers 2. Yeah, that movie. And we'll do that right after we break here for the news on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. That's where we do our Monday morning show. And then we're downstairs in the showcase studio for the rest of the week. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to be talking about actors and actresses who are basically known for comedic performances, but then have really done some interesting dramatic work as well. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time on a Monday morning. And we're wrapping up the Monday morning movie reviews, and then we'll talk box office with Eric Childress. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, Super Troopers 2, where are you on this one? Yeah.
Well, you know, comedy is in trouble when you're sitting there watching it and you don't even crack a smile for about the first 20 to 25 minutes of the movie. And that's where I found myself with this. And I have, you know, generally been on board with the Broken Lizard films. I like Beer Fest. I think everything Michael Clark Duncan does in The Slammin' Salmon is funnier than anything that happens in this movie. And while I might not come up short of calling Club Dread a masterpiece, I think it is absolutely their funniest film that they've done. Most on target, most laughs per quotient, and Super Troopers 2, I think, is their worst film. I mean, this is a film that was in limbo for a very long time. I mean, it's been 16 years since the first one actually hit theaters, 17 if you count when it actually premiered at Sundance. And, you know, so they crowdfunded this thing, and I think about 80% of the budget went into securing the trademark to doing Canadian accents. Because they lean so heavily on doing that without ever really, you know, coming up with an idea to sort of skewer the kind of American-Canadian relationship. You know, I'm not expecting Fish Called Wanda type material here, and you know, and culture wars. But you know, there are a couple jokes that they throw towards the Americans, and then obviously there are a lot of jokes at the Canadians' expense. But you know, this movie just seems toothless in wanting to go anything any further than that. I don't know exactly how much weed these guys smoked while putting this screenplay together, but it kind of falls under my sort of my Kevin Smith rule that, you know, the idea that weed sparks creativity can be sometimes a myth, or at least it doesn't work for everybody. Because the laughs in this movie, I mean, I think I'm probably, Colin, I probably laughed at the same three or four things, and that section where they do the montage of what essentially is most of the stuff that people remember from the first movie, let's be honest here, is them screwing with the people that they pull over. And that's really all of that is thrown into a montage here, and that has the funniest stuff in the movie. And even some of the outtakes at the end about that montage have a couple of funny bits as well. But beyond that, I mean, the plot is, you know, not that we care about the plot, but, you know, it's not that far removed from the first movie, right down to relationships and whatnot. The whole gag of Chandrasekhar's character getting hooked on female hormone pills, other than the joke about him losing all sense of direction, that's the only joke about that I laughed at. And everything else, almost nothing worked for me in this movie. I sat there kind of not laughing, even falling asleep at one point, frankly. I think this is a genuine miss. And the Super Troopers movies, to me, the two worst films in their resume.
It's not good. I think I laughed a little bit more than you guys did. There were certain things in there, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, what works in this movie is recycled from the first movie. All the stuff that, like you said, Eric, all the stuff that everybody remembers from the first movie. And you know, they, whatever gets the big laughs in this movie, comes from that. I think the first Super Troopers is pretty funny. I think there's some really funny moments in it. And I remember, you know, the first time I saw it, I laughed quite a bit, and I was like, okay, I like these guys, and I hope they continue to make movies. And I think Beer Fest is, like, by far their best movie. I like Club Dread as well. But Beer Fest, to me, is just hysterical. I could watch that movie 24 hours a day. I think it's hilarious. I mean, just for Donald Sutherland alone, you know. So, but there are laughs in this one, but it does seem like, you know, I mean, again, this is another one of these sequels that who was waiting for this? You know what I mean? It's been 17 years, and, you know, I mean, did we have to wait 20 years for a Zoolander? You know, I mean, it's like, I don't know if there was an audience. Well, apparently there was an audience, because it did a lot better than a hell of a lot better than I thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
So evidently people wanted to see it, and it did. I mean, the first Super Troopers has become, you know, a big cult film and a big movie with potheads. So, you know, and they obviously went out of their way to make sure that connection was there. They opened it on 420 and made a big deal out of that. I don't know. I was not high when I saw this movie, so I didn't laugh as much as someone who was high probably would. But, you know, sometimes when people get high, they laugh at test patterns. So that doesn't really say anything about the quality of the comedy that's involved. But I laughed a little bit more than you guys did. There were some bits that I thought was funny. I think Brian Cox is great in both movies. You know, there's not enough Brian Cox in the movie. But there's some cameos in it that are kind of funny. And so I'm not recommending it, but I don't think it's terrible. And I don't really necessarily think that we needed a sequel to Super Troopers. So anyway,
I'll tell you what, I had the same kind of experience you had, Nick, many years ago when you saw, I think you said it was Scary Movie or Scary Movie 2, when you were sitting next to a little girl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there was a little girl at the screening I was at for this movie. Don't bring your kids.
Yeah. That was the last time. The last time that that happened, I was just appalled because not only did these parents come in late, but they had like what appeared to be like a 7 or 8 year old and a toddler, and it was Deadpool. I was like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I realize it's a comic book movie, but check out the content and check out the rating.
Yeah,
right.
So stupid. Hey, there's a little indie movie coming out next week.
Yeah, The Writer.
You know, the Grace Jones documentary is coming out, right? There's this little movie called Avengers Infinity War. That'll be coming out, and it's it'll be interesting to see how much money that thing makes. It's going to be crazy. So we'll have that and a lot more to talk about. Colin, thanks, man. Have a great week.
Chicago Critics Film Festival, y'all. Be there.
Yeah, Chicago Critics Film Festival starts May 4th at the Music Box Theater. Chicago Critics Festival is, and you can check that out, and in the Music Box Theater as well. All right, Colin, take care, buddy. We'll see you next week. Okay, there you go. Eric, let's get into the box office here.
Okay.
So we said it last week that there was a possibility.
Yeah.
That A Quiet Place would return back to number one, and it did. $22 million, man.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie that, I mean, this is, you know, when people say, you know, what exactly does it mean, you know, word of mouth and whatnot, this is exactly what it means, that, you know, not only is the competition not generating the kind of, you know, certainly not repeat viewing, but the kind of interest that a movie like this that people just can't stop talking about, and you see dips of, you know, high, you know, 50 million to 33 million last week or whatever, 31 million and now 22 million this week. Those are incredibly solid drops, and this movie is still on pace to do somewhere just probably shy of 200 million, which is just, I mean, an incredible success for Paramount, fantastic for Krasinski, who I think has already booked his next directorial effort, what it looks like a sci-fi movie, which is just, that just makes me incredibly happy. I mean, this is the movie of the moment until next week, obviously, but you know, to return to number one after dropping off is always a very cool accomplishment.
Well, I mean, you know, this is it's like the Get Out of this year in terms of in terms of, you know, like it being the movie that everybody's talking about, a low budget film that suddenly just is just grabbing everybody. And it's a great movie too. I mean, that's the other thing. It deserves all this success because it's great.
Yeah, without question.
Number two is Rampage, $21 million, bringing its total up to $66 million. That's not great.
No, not great. It's done again, but it's done very well overseas. It's done like over 220, 216 million or something like that overseas. So it doesn't have that far to go to make it to profit. It's about another 75, 76 million.
Yeah.
You know, probably, you know, it's going to garner probably another 25 million or so in the U.S. alone, maybe even a little more than that. I mean, this film looks like it's headed towards profit. It's just not sort of a big slam bang success. It'll get there, most likely. But
all right, number three is I Feel Pretty, $16.2 million. How did that did better than Snatched, right? Opening weekend.
No, Snatched actually. Well, Snatched had the benefit because they were advertising the movie. It was Mother's Day weekend.
Well, right.
And so you have the Goldie, the Amy mother-daughter relationship, and they advertised that, and so it had like a kind of an increase because of Mother's Day, and that so it was like $19.5 million. So this one's lower than that, and I don't see it going much further. It was, I mean, it did better than they were anticipating. They were anticipating this in like low, like 11 to 14 million, and originally it was projected to do about 18.5. Clearly, the Friday crowd wasn't recommending it very well because it came down to 16. But you know, it's an okay opening, but it looks like it's another film that's probably not going to make its way into the profit category for Schumer.
Okay. Number four, this is I was surprised to see the numbers here. Super Troopers 2, $14.7 million. I think all of Broken Lizard's fans went, every one of them.
Yeah, and the 420 thing might have been a factor. I mean, not that I saw in a theater full of weed smoke or anything, but you know, it's very possible that it was a very front-loaded Friday. Whether it's $14 million or $16 million, I mean, this movie, again, it only caught, they raised $4.4 million for this thing, and didn't play it at any festival, so there's literally no buzz, no pun intended. Coming off this movie, but none of the Broken Lizard films in the past have even broached $20 million.
Yeah,
and this is probably going to do that in its first week.
Yeah,
so it's a success. I mean, it might drop off. It'll probably drop off huge next week.
Yeah,
but this thing makes $30 million. They're going to green light their next movie, which I understand is going to be a sequel to Beer Fest.
Oh, cool!
Called Pot Fest.
Pop Fest.
Pot Fest.
Oh, Pot Fest. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. All right. So number five is Blumhouse's Truth or Dare with $7.9 million. It's $30 million. That's a hit.
Yeah, because it costs $6 to make.
Right. Number six, Ready Player One, $7.5 million, $126.1 million total in America.
Over $500 million worldwide. The sixth film of Spielberg's career to cross $500 million, which sounds weird, but you consider that, your E.T. and, or not E.T., but like Raiders and some of those early movies, for inflation-wise, over $500 million.
Oh, sure,
but,
yeah.
But just pure dollar, figures for the time, this is the sixth movie of his career to cross that threshold.
Wow. All right. Number seven, Blocker, $6.9 million, $48 million total.
Yeah. Oh, so it's okay. Yeah. Didn't quite catch on the way I thought it might, but the drop this week was pretty decent, so it's probably going to, it could find its way to over $60
million. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then, of course, Black Panther, number eight, $4.6 million, $681 million just in America.
Yeah, guaranteeing a spot in the top 10 next week when Avengers comes out.
Right.
And I think people are clearly catching up.
Yeah.
On it as well. People want to be, who haven't seen it yet. I know people who haven't seen it yet, and there'll probably be people who might do double features next week.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised. And number nine, Traffic, $3.8 million. There were three people in the theater besides me and my folks.
Yeah, it was only in 1,000 theaters, so, I mean, that's not exactly for the amount of theaters, not exactly a horrible average, but it is decidedly average.
Mm-hmm. And then number 10, Isle of Dogs, $3.4 million, $24.6 million total. It seemed to me that they increased the advertising budget for this, because they're really pushing it on TV now.
The ads are everywhere for this thing. I see it frequently. And I think that they kind of botched the release a little bit. I think they didn't get it out right when it was, hot, basically. They platformed it and then should have got it out there in as many theaters as possible the next weekend, but they kind of waited on it.
Yeah.
And I think the whatever allure that there might have had with the critics that first week just never really caught on, while all these other movies like Ready Player One and all these other ones, Quiet Place obviously taking over the marketplace, and Rampage and so forth.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, what are you projecting for Infinity War?
Well, I mean, I think it's unquestionably going to be the biggest movie of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to outgross Black Panther, which some people have suggested.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think the film is going to cross $500 million in the U.S., so it'll be that high. And it would not surprise me if next week you see it in the top three. Highest opening weekends ever.
Yeah.
I think that, $200 million is guaranteed. It wouldn't surprise me if it beats Last Jedi's $220 and ends up second, only to Force Awakens, which is $247.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I'm seeing it this weekend.
Well, the numbers are going to be huge.
Yeah.
They're going to be huge. All right, Eric, we'll talk about that next week.
Sounds great.
All right, man, take care. Eric Childress right there. And check out Chicago Critics Film Festival at the Music Box. Starts on May 4th. And we'll talk all the new movies coming up next week as well. But right now we got a break for weather and traffic, and I got your weather right here.